Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the May 18th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. That's the regular schedule. But since I will be flying back from Washington, D.C. next Wednesday, after participating in the Move Over APAC conference when my next regular program is scheduled, I switch dates with Joy LeClaire and Forthright Radio, and Joy will be taking my spot next week. APAC, Israel, and Palestine are very much in the news this week, and today's program deals with a subject that involves all three. It's a controversial Goldstone report, named after Judge Richard Goldstone, a Jewish South African who headed a UN commission charged by the UN with investigating allegations of war crimes committed by Israel and Hamas during Israel's Operation Cast Lead against the people of Gaza from the last week of December 2008 through the first part of January 2009. The Commission of Distinguished Jurists, headed by Goldstone, found that both sides had been guilty of crimes against humanity, but it came down most heavily on Israel, since the people of Gaza, as well as the besieged strip's infrastructure, were the war's main victims, 1,400 Palestinians dead compared to 13 Israeli soldiers, three of them by so-called friendly fire. The response to the report on the part of Israel and its supporters in the U.S., paid and unpaid, not the least of which was APAC, was predictable. They quickly launched into a vicious personal attack against Goldstone and the UN without, of course, bothering to read any of the 400-page report, virtually excommunicating the distinguished judge, who not only is a Zionist and strong supporter of Israel, but is on the board of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. In short, led by the likes of attorney Alan Dershowitz, Goldstone was vilified as a traitor, a self-hating Jew, and accused of blood libel against Israel and the Jewish people. In the tightly knit South African Jewish community, of which he was an intrinsic part, Goldstone was denounced and treated as if he were a leper, and at one point was going to be refused attendance at his grandson's bar mitzvah. Last month, after returning from a meeting in South Africa with the country's main Zionist organization, and clearly under tremendous pressure, Goldstone wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post in which he recanted from the report's conclusion that Israel had deliberately targeted Palestinian civilians, despite considerable evidence in the report to the contrary. Israel's supporters seized upon the op-ed as if he had renounced the entire report, which he hadn't, and demanded the UN throw out the report in its entirety, failing to mention that Goldstone's turnabout was not endorsed by the other two judges who participated in the findings. On cue, the Israeli occupying Congress quickly responded by introducing H.R. 1501, which would, quote, withhold U.S. contributions to the UN until the UN formally retracts the final report of the, quote, United Nations fact-finding mission on the Gaza conflict. The bill has been referred for action to the Foreign Affairs Committee, whose chair, Eliana Ross-Lehtin, and Democratic ranking member Howard Berman are sure to support it, almost sure. In the meantime, Philip Weiss and Adam Horowitz, co-hosts of the Mondo Weiss Block, probably the most important site on the Israel-Palestine issue from a pro-Palestinian perspective, and Lizzie Ratner, have put together a book containing a lengthy analysis and commentary on the Goldstone Report, which contains additional information obtained by the investigators, which was not included in the formal report. On Thursday, May 5th, Phil and Adam were joined by Palestinian-American law professor George Bisharat at the First Congregational Church in Oakland to discuss the Goldstone Report and its implications in an event hosted by the Middle East Children's Alliance, an event that I attended and recorded. That's what you're going to hear this morning at a quarter past the hour. This past Sunday, May 15th, marked the 63rd anniversary of Israel's declaration of statehood, which for Palestinians was anything but a time to celebrate. For it marked the expulsion of some 750,000 Palestinians from their native homeland and the destruction of close to 500 villages by the armed Jewish settlers, most of whom claimed the land was rightfully theirs, having been given to them by a god that their ancestors had created centuries before. Those who were secular and wanted a more legalistic justification pointed to their declaration in 1917 by Britain's Lord Balfour that Jews should have a homeland in Arab Palestine, which was later approved by the League of Nations. It was their reward for what the British apparently believed was a Zionist role in getting the U.S. to enter World War I on their side, which turned a potential defeat at the hands of Germany into an Allied victory. The ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians has, though, never ended. According to documents obtained by Haaretz, Israel used a covert procedure to cancel the residency status of 140,000 West Bank Palestinians between 1967 and 1994 if they were out of the country for more than 6 months. This past Sunday, taking a leaf from the pages of the new Nonviolent Arab Spring, thousands of Palestinians from villages and refugee camps across all of Israel's borders, real and virtual, from Lebanon, Syria, the West Bank, and Gaza, decided to return to their homeland and those of their parents by foot and largely nonviolently. They were met, not surprisingly, with violence, and 12 Palestinians were killed by Israeli soldiers and scores more injured, and those in the West Bank arrested. Washington's response was as predictable as had been Israel's. During the Monday press briefing, in which new White House spokesperson Jay Carney announced that President Obama would address the opening session of AIPAC's annual policy conference Sunday morning, Carney expressed regret for those who were killed in last Sunday's clashes, but defended Israel's right to take measures to protect its borders. "We regret the loss of life," said Carney, "and our thoughts are with the families and loved ones of those killed and wounded. And Israel, like all countries, has the right to prevent unauthorized crossings at its borders. Its neighbors have responsibility to prevent such activity." Again, in typical White House form, he concluded, "We urge maximum restraint on all sides," end quote. Obama indeed will be speaking to an AIPAC audience, which is unlikely to afford him the rousing standing ovation, or should I say ovations, that await Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when on Monday he addresses what is expected to be the largest annual AIPAC policy conference ever, with more than 1,000 persons attending, and that's not including half the members of the House and the Senate. Yossi Werder, writing in Haaretz, noted that on the eve of Israel's Independence Day, Netanyahu met with some members of Congress, including Israeli loyalist and my former Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, who were in Jerusalem for the festivities. Netanyahu, wrote Werder, gave them an overview about Iran, about the upheavals in the Middle East, about security arrangements, and again about Iran. One member of the delegation commented, quote, "I'm not sure that will satisfy the president." "I'm not coming to Washington in order to satisfy the president," Netanyahu retorted, according to what someone who was present at the meeting told an Israeli friend. "We are meeting for a conversation." And that will be this Friday. On Tuesday, the Israeli prime minister will address a flock that appreciates him far more than does his own Knesset, and that's the U.S. Congress, where he can count on receiving a tumultuous welcome. Outside in the street beyond his earshot, there will be a demonstration organized by Code Pink, which will follow the Move Over AIPAC conference that begins on Friday. On Saturday, I'll be speaking on a panel with Grant Smith of the Institute for Research on the Middle East, or IRMEP, who you've heard several times on this program, and Janet McMahon of the Washington Report on the Middle East. Our topic? AIPAC, what it is and how it works. Tomorrow, President Obama is expected to reset American policy in the Middle East with a major address offering a comprehensive look at the Arab Spring, a, quote, unified theory about the popular uprisings from Tunisia to Bahrain, and possibly a new administration approach to the region. In the meantime, notes Nick Turse on Salon.com, all signs indicate that the Pentagon, barring an unprecedented and almost inconceivable policy shift, will continue to broker lucrative deals to send weapons, systems, and military equipment to Arab despots. Nothing indicates that it will be deterred from its course, whatever the president says, which means that Barack Obama's recent rhetoric is unlikely to translate into meaningful policy change in the region. For months now, Turse writes, the world has watched as protesters have taken to the streets across the Middle East and North Africa to demand a greater say in their lives. In Bahrain and Yemen, they were shot down in the streets as they demanded democracy. In the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, they called for reforms, free speech, and basic rights, and ended up bloody and often in jail cells. In Iraq, they protested a lack of food and jobs, and response got bullets and beatings. As the world watched, trained eyes couldn't help noticing something startling about the tools of repression in those countries. The armored personnel carriers, tanks, and helicopters used to intimidate or even kill peaceful protesters were often American models, and they are likely to remain that way. Finally, there's a massacre that took place last month. Didn't get much coverage, and that was apparently ignored by the alternative press. It happened in the early morning hours of April 8th in Iraq, when Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, acting at the behest of Iran, sent 2,500 armed soldiers with 140 armored vehicles into Camp Ashraf, 40 miles north of Baghdad, and home to the exiled Iranian dissident group, the People's Mujahideen, or Mujahideen Khalq, killing 34 defenseless residents and wounding more than 300. The people of Camp Ashraf were disarmed by U.S. forces in 2009, agreeing to lay down their weapons and renounce violence in return for U.S. protection. Although U.S. soldiers were in the vicinity, they didn't get that protection. Video of that Iraqi assault can be found on YouTube.